to Two Pints on the Corner. And we have a special guest today, Black Star Liner.
Morning, Kevin. This is Kevin Aylmer we're talking to this morning, who was a big part of the channel. Promotions, marketing, DJ, in-house expert on all things world music, reggae, African, etc. And Kevin has some clear memories and some hazy memories that he'd like to share with us. Morning, Kevin.
Morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Good morning, Rob.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you first became involved with the channel, because you were in there before Dinky and I were. We didn't join until the mid-80s, and I know you'd been in pretty much from the beginning.
Well, yeah, it takes us back to 1980, 81. And I had left California, left graduate school, finished graduate school in California, and came to Boston. And on a whim, I had heard about this club called The Channel, and I decided to go down there and talk with the owners. And I proposed to them very briefly and succinctly that I was a world music enthusiast, finished a course in ethnomusicology at UCLA, although my major areas were history and psychology. But I had an idea of why not have the channel have a series of world music concerts, and I would be glad to propose suitable candidates for it, and also to help with the press release, put a public relations network together of college radio stations, and you know, do everything necessary to make the concerts work. And I had spoken with Harry Boris, who was one of the Boris brothers, and he was very enthusiastic about the idea, said, yeah, you're welcome, and by all means, go to it.
Did you start from scratch when you were contacting the radio stations? Like, did you have contacts already? Or
I did.
Yeah,
I did. Yeah. When I came back from California, I was wise in knowledge, but not so much money in my pocket. So I heard about this campus calendar newspaper that went to all these colleges around New England. So I contacted the editor there, and I said, why don't you let me do a radio column, a college radio column? And he said, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. So I wound up doing that for years and years and years, because they already had a lot of the radio stations there, many of which played reggae music, Caribbean music, African music, world music.
There weren't many outlets in Boston at the time, right, Kevin? Because the promoters weren't really embracing world music at that time. The established promoters.
Right. Which was a gold mine for us because, you know, the network was essentially for world music enthusiasts as well as college students who were open to it. And I knew there was I hesitate to use the term, a market there. You know,
right. So do you remember the first show that went in?
No, I don't actually. I'd have to look it up. I do have a calendar of all that sort of thing.
The Axie was the iTunes July 30th, 1980. Kid Creole and the Coconuts on the 17th of October. December 14th, the iTunes and Raz Khalil with WCAS DJ. Okay, in 81, March 5th. Steel Pulse.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That sounds right. That was an early one in, and
that was DJ was Peter Simon on that one. And that was
right.
Wow. Oh, good love, Peter. Yeah.
And then May 14th was Steel Pulse again. La Peste, Healing of the Nation, and then July 19th was Toots and the Maytals and Jamala, Healing of the Nation.
Wow. Yeah.
And that was 81. That was all it was in 80 and 81. 82, we have our friend Denroy Morgan on January 21st, One People, and then May 20th was the iTunes, DJ Jamboree, and Little Brigadier, the General, Papa Iver Love, and then June 16th, Steel Pulse. So basically, you were Michael Perkins from WERS was there then. Then September 15th, Black Uhuru with Sly Dunbar and Robbie Shakespeare. They had to reschedule that, though, because of trying to... That was the other thing, trying to get in the country from Jamaica. We were one of the first shows that would have any of those artists. That was one of the first shows that would do before they started going through America, was the Channel.
They'd come through before they started the tour.
Exactly.
Was that... You would have taken over then that early 80s, Kevin, as the...
Black Star Liner.
As the Black Star Liner,
down
yeah.
here was June 13th, the Clash of the DJs. Holly D, Mike Perkins, Scotty Dredd, Ja Prince, and the Black Star Liner. And then that was the first one I've got on my notes. And then June 15th, Bob Marley tribute, Rare Film from You Know Who. And I Tell, June the 21st. Yeah.
So about when they were booking those, Kevin, what was their, before you got involved, do you know about the booking process? Because it sounds to me like, you know, Steel Pulse was obviously coming out of England.
Yeah.
So they would have been coming through the agents that they were already booking some of the English acts, and that kind of would have opened the door then to it being a reggae room.
Yeah, interestingly enough, and for the historical record, the first venue that featured Steel Pulse was the Bradford Ballroom.
Right.
Ah, okay. But was it done by the Channel?
No.
An
independent promoter, right?
Yeah. That was the first time I saw them. That's where they did Ku Klux Klan all coming out in white sheets.
Wow.
No.
Oh, wow.
I worked with Steel Pulse again last summer, Kevin, at the time.
Yeah.
Still going strong.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
But they were kind of a crossover act, right? I mean, your enthusiasm and it was what brought in some of the rarer acts, a lot of the African acts and a lot of the more eclectic beat stuff.
Yeah, it took me a bit of time before I could really understand what Steel Pulse was all about. But they're a first-generation group whose parents came from Jamaica back in the 1940s, and then they grew up in a place called Birmingham and Handsworth, that neighborhood. And they represented, you know, a hybrid mix of growing up in England, but still retaining and trying to find their Jamaican roots.
Ah. Well, reggae had been popular in England, right, before here.
I mean,
late 60s, but before that, the sound system guys in the early 60s in London, from that, from Jamaica's independence and the fact that they were, many of the Jamaicans were still British citizens and had the rights to emigrate and work and find housing in England. So there was that major influx of Jamaican culture.
Yeah, my first contact with all that was in Brixton back in 1970. And I was living in London for a year, and I really explored that time and that area and doing research at the British Museum on Garvey. Uh-huh. So it, you know, was in the back of my mind. But like I said, when I heard that Steel Pulse was going to be at the Bradford Ballroom, I made sure to get down there. Told some friends about it. They were pretty amazed, too.
Yeah. You know?
How did you get involved with sort of pursuing Marcus Garvey? Was that from being a history major? And you know, at what point did you suddenly become interested in that?
Well, I had hopes of going to graduate school to do research on New England Transcendentalism. Until I woke up one day and realized that there'd been enough written about that. Uh-huh. That, really, I mean, why go over all that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, a beaten path. And at the same time, I was rather enamored of this fellow named Marcus Garvey, this Jamaican. And the more I read about him, I realized that there's an amazing story here that needs to be retold and revised. You know, what we call revisionist history.
Yeah.
And then I kept hearing on the radio all these reggae songs with references to Marcus Garvey. And I said, well, that's it. There it is, you know?
Yeah.
You could do a study of why did Garvey, who died in 1941, and why is he coming back into significance among all these musicians and artists and poets, African-American academics, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that if I wanted to do this world music thing, I could combine that with research on Garvey and ask virtually everybody I interviewed, which is probably in the area of 140 people, about always threw that question in.
Yeah.
You know, like, who's Garvey to you?
Yeah.
And I got, you know, a pretty amazing display of different opinions about who he was from all these different perspectives, whether they were people from Africa or the Caribbean or Jamaica or elsewhere.
For people listening to this who don't know much or maybe even anything about Marcus Garvey, can you give sort of a capsule description of his significance and who he was?
Well, it was a mixture. I would say most people didn't know too much. Most people would quote one of the famous slogans about going back to Africa,
yeah,
which is a misnomer because Garvey never championed the idea of all the African Americans going back to Africa. He said a lot of them aren't any good here, and they wouldn't be any good there, which was pretty blunt. But he wanted to establish a beachhead in West Africa for those who wanted to go back to the quote-unquote homeland and start their own nation. And that, of course, was Liberia, which didn't thrill the Liberian establishment too much.
Mm-hmm. Tell us, you mentioned earlier when we were pre-chatting about the channel and the location.
Right.
And Boston at the time in the 80s. What was your perception of where it was and why it would be a good draw, if you like, for that audience, yeah, you know, where it was physically in South Boston?
Well, I hadn't really done any kind of research. It was just that word of mouth and getting to know some of the musicians, the local reggae artists and all that, I got hipped up to what was happening in the local area, much of which was centered on the Western Front with Marvin Gilmore's place over in Cambridge on Western Avenue. So I got the word about what was going on. And then when I went down there, I thought, well, there it is. It's behind South Station, down Summer Street, over the Fort Point Channel, and then you take a left into Necco Street, and there's acres of free parking, which was the big selling point, right?
Right.
And
the 2 o'clock.
Yeah. And not only that, but I didn't think too much about the fact that it was right there on the edge of South Boston, and that was a little problematic at first. Mm-hmm. You know, the channel people were not welcomed with open arms by certain elements of the people in South Boston.
Right.
But, you know, it had such a range of different music playing down there.
I think you and I have been speaking about that in the last few podcasts, that was the fascinating part to us, was that it was a different place determined by whoever the hacks were every night, you know.
Right. But the ambience of the channel, you know, formerly the Mad Hatter, long, low, flat-roofed base, painted white and black, wrought iron gateway, business offices to the right, small box office.
And Tony built you a wonderful DJ booth with camouflage all over it.
Mm-hmm. And but the thing about the club was that it had this marvelous sound system. And I had done college radio at the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut as an undergrad. And I had done basically European and American folk music, but I was rather taken by the idea of sound and vinyl. And that was a thing that whenever I talked with people over the years, that was one of the things they mentioned about the channel, was that it had this intimidating row of speaker cabinets on either side of the stage, a quad system designed by yours truly, sound engineer extraordinary, Stuart Dinky Dawson. And that the sound was almost like a cathedral in there. And I remember one time we had Third World come in, and they had been on a concert tour. They had their own sound system that they used, and they brought their sound system in and used their sound system rather than the channel sound system, which caused a bit of a delay. I could never figure out exactly why they wanted to do it, but they were using it on the tour, so I could understand that now.
Making the club pay for it. I was making money.
Yeah, but it was this cathedral-style wraparound sound like the channel had, but a little bit overpowering because it was really designed for stadiums and outdoor places, not for a place like the channel. But but of course, finally, that it was right across the street from the South Station U.S. Postal Service. And the thing you could always remember about the channel were lingering fragrances of beer, tobacco fumes, Pine Sol, exotic perfumes, license, or incense, actually, popcorn, and occasionally global cuisines.
And sticking to the floor, yeah.
Yeah.
What are some of the most memorable shows for you, Kevin?
Oh, that's a big question. Let's see. I made a list of 90 shows that I was involved in, and that's only a partial list. And so I did give that all some thought. And I would say Miriam Makeba and Hugh Masekela, yeah, which we did at Symphony Hall.
I remember.
The Fela show at the Opera House.
The Opera House.
Yeah. And
Fela played the channel, right, as well?
Who?
Kuti
with
Fela.
I only saw the Opera House,
but I saw some listings.
Uh-huh. Yeah, not that I know of. But also there was a World Beat Festival at the channel in 1991 with Soca King era, Ladysmith Black Mambazo,
yeah,
from South Africa, and Third World from Jamaica, all on the same bill.
I actually have the radio commercial for that.
Uh-huh.
That was a show that moved from Mansfield, and I think because of sales or whatever, but they moved the show into the channel.
Good for us.
And I have that, because I remember Ladysmith particularly.
Uh-huh.
I just looked at Arrow is in my notes. There's always a good story with Arrow, right?
Uh-huh.
For people who don't know, Arrow is the guy who wrote Hot, Hot, Hot.
Mm.
Right. Soca King.
The Soca King, one of the biggest wedding songs, I think, in the country at this point, or party songs. And it was sold, if I'm not wrong, Kevin, it was sold to David Johansen, right? Buster Poindexter of the New York Dolls. For pretty short money, Arrow sold it outright.
Yeah.
And then it continued to tour on it, but David Johansen collects all the all the revenues.
So also the Saw Doctors from Ireland. That was an absolutely amazing show. It was one of the first times I had seen, this is in October 91,
mm-hmm,
and the crowd, before the doors opened, went out literally to the street. Just one long line, like you'd see in the Great Depression. And because I got there early.
What a famine.
Yeah. I got there early to set up because I had a special set that I had put together of Celtic music. And it was an amazing performance, but that couldn't be, that amazing performance wasn't confined to just what was going on stage. It was almost another performance in the audience because most of the people got very happy.
Yeah.
And I remember from my vantage point very clearly that towards the end of the evening, the big barrels that had always been placed for rubbish were being used by certain people to spin around. People would jump in and their friends would spin the barrels around.
That's great.
Well, there's nothing like an Irish party, you know.
No, and it was not an audience you would see at the Boston Symphony.
That was a real one-off, Kevin, and I've been lucky enough to work with the Saw Doctors for many years. I've been playing major festivals, but that show was actually their second night in America in 91. And they'd played a warm-up, I think, the night before in Easton.
Hmm.
And that came about because a couple of Irish promoters came into the club one day, And I was booking at the time, and they had their thick Irish accents, and the management or owners of the channel weren't really making much sense of what they had to say, so they passed them on to me. Unfortunately, I'd just come back from the UK in '90, and I'd read about the Saw Doctors, and they had one hit record at the time, so I was a little bit familiar with them, and the guys told me that they wanted to rent the club on a Sunday night and bring this unknown band in, and they could sell it out, which of course we heard.
That was October 6th.
Yeah, we heard from every promoter in town that they could sell the club out every day. So we made a deal. We made an interesting deal because I wanted to get the owners to approve it because I liked the guys. And so I proposed they pay us a high rental fee against the bar sales, so that I think it was every $1,000 that they spent over the bar would come off the rent.
And
knowing an Irish audience, they of course drank the place dry.
Mm-hmm.
I remember going down to Jay Foley's that night to borrow kegs at midnight to keep the bars alive.
Wow.
And had a great relationship with the band ever since. But, yeah, I've worked many shows with them. And it's good you remember that one, because that was, to me, that was a very memorable evening.
It was, yeah. Yeah. My only regret in all the years that I was there, when I look back now, is that the channel couldn't hire the Pogues.
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah, that would have...
And that was probably through the agency connections, I would think. I did go the night to see them at Spit, I think their first show.
Yeah.
And it was one of the few nights I ever left the channel early to go see anybody else play.
Pogues. Ooh.
There were quite a few Irish shows in there, though, and you would have worked most of them, right? I remember Stockton's Wing.
Yeah.
Bagatelle.
The Clan, the Furies.
The Furies, right, yep.
The Wolf Tones.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you have quite a bit there.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Marley film is becoming so popular right now. Do you remember the Rita Marley tribute night? That was there. I would say 85 or 86. I vaguely remember it. I was in there as a bartender, but I remember there was film and she had the kids with them and an assortment of Jamaican celebrities.
Yeah, she was the grand dame.
Right.
And by that time, the I3, you know, Bob Marley's backup female vocalist, had pretty much less performances together, and they were really going out individually.
And that was Judy.
Marcia Griffiths.
Yeah.
Judy Mowat and Rita.
We had all of them.
Would the kids have been with them that night, Kevin? Do you remember? Was Ziggy with them, or?
I don't remember. No, they did bring in Ziggy Marley and the Melody Makers for another concert.
Right.
And that was quite an entourage.
Oh, yeah.
People with that. But no, I don't remember the children.
Yeah, you remember. I mean, most of the reggae shows, as I remember, were pretty chaotic, because we'd have very vague advance work on them. It was always hard to pin down a tour manager or a manager or a production manager or anybody who really knew what was going on until the day of the show.
Fly by night.
I'm sure you encountered plenty of that, too, but... It was always interesting. It was always some of the more challenging shows to do.
Especially if you had metal in the afternoon.
Yeah, I remember those days. You remember many of those, Kevin, when we do an all-ages hardcore Sunday afternoon?
No, I went in to get my check once in a while. And
then we do a regular
show. I took one look. Right. I took one look and ran out of there.
But then we'd have to turn the club over and put a reggae show in there at night, the traditional stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Lots of, I was saying to Dinky last week, lots of Hy-Vee's Bristol cream and orange juice.
Yeah, stage diving, that sort of thing.
tell us about the Yellow Man situation that you had to
deal
with.
Give a story.
Uh-huh. Yellow Man, huh?
Yeah.
How many times? Yellow Man played several times, right?
Oh, all the time.
Oh, yeah. But Yellow Man.
He used to do the nursery rhymes, yeah, and all the oldies going to the chapel and...
Yeah. Yeah, Yellow Man was quite a celebrity, to be sure.
So why is he called
a
Yellow
white
Man?
White Jamaican, albino.
Albino, yeah.
Oh. And raised as a Jamaican who had a very rough childhood, didn't really fit in with the white community, with the black community, with anybody, because he was such a singular appearance person. And somehow he struck it rich, turning that around and using that as his signature, that he was Yellow Man, King Yellow Man. And as those of us who worked with him, his name is Winston Foster. That's what his real name is. And as anybody who spent time with him noticed, I took him to an interview, and that's the part of the story which I'll tell you in a moment. But the thing is that there was this magical transformation that happened as soon as he hit the stage, literally. He just became another person, and he started doing all these interpretations and these wild fantasies, like waking up in Queen Elizabeth's bedroom, among others. And among others. But I had this opportunity to take him over to WERS And for some reason, he wasn't really excited about that. He didn't want to leave the club, and he was really reluctant to. And I had to really push him on that. I said, "Well, you know, WERS, it was, you know, out of Emerson College, who was our mainstay college outlet, and had really been pushing the show." And consequently, this is probably around 6 o'clock or so. There was a line out there waiting to get in, which is, you know, pretty early for a show. And I finally coaxed him. I said, "Look, my car's just outside. I'll take you over there, and we just make it short and sweet, just to keep them happy and do what we need to do." So he gets into the car, gets into the back seat, and lies flat on the floor. I said, "Yo, are you okay back there?" And he says, yeah, I'm on. I'm cool. And every now and then, move up a little bit, look out the window, and then he jumped back down, in my Volkswagen, by the way. And I said, "Yellow, you okay?" Yeah, I'm on. Let's go. So off we went. And when I got back, the line was even longer. And he was literally petrified. He didn't want anybody to see him. He said, "Don't let me off over here by the front door. Let's go around by the stage door." Then even that was, that was pretty crowded too. So let's move over here. And he finally put his jacket over his head and ran in. And then the next day, when I got back in my car, I noticed that on the back part of my seat in the Volkswagen, he had written, "Yellow Man was here." Yeah.
Wow.
Winston Foster.
We did. He played a couple of times, right?
Oh, yeah. I think Ross Jr. got involved in that at one point, driving him around, too.
Yeah.
I think they went out to get some food and then got into an automobile accident and just around the corner from the channel. So he got there late for his sound check. But, I'm sure Yellow Man has some serious memories of his work at the channel.
Well, we got big. I mean, there's nothing but big names came through there from the world of reggae and world majors. Dinky and I look back over the history and the database that he compiled from the Phoenix. So it gets pretty impressive and rare stuff too. Things like Alpha Blondie. And what do you think was the? Again, I'll go back to the question I asked you earlier. What's the one big standout in your mind? What was the biggest kick you got out of an act?
I have three of those, not necessarily associated with the channel, but out of my top three, one of them is a channel show, and that's King Sonny Ode.
Ah, yeah. There you go. Tell the audience out there what pasting is.
What? Excuse me?
Pasting. Are we saying?
Pasting.
Oh, pasting, sure. So, once again, the premier appearance of King Sonny Ode was at the Bradford Ballroom.
That's right. No, this is channel promoting.
Okay, the channel did it at the ballroom?
No, that was different.
Yeah.
But, that was atmospheric, that show. I had never seen anything like it. And, he had his whole ensemble with the talking drum, and that's all I can say. I mean, words just defy explanation. It was juju music. That was the genre that he called it. The pasting is a African tradition that the audience is invited to show their appreciation of the musicianship and the performance at a certain point towards the end of the show, where they're encouraged, actually, to come up and bring some money, and preferably money is somewhat wet, and they take it to one of their musicians, one of the favorite musicians, not only King Sonny Ode, but say his synthesizer player, Damola Atapoju, and paste the money on the person's head, on their forehead. And so after a while, you see all these musicians with money all over their faces and on their heads, which indicates this has been a well-received performance. And that's the tradition. And, you know, we had Ebenezer Obey from Zaire, same thing. And other artists, but
didn't they do that with you when you were DJing down there, Kevin? Didn't paste the Black Star liner in the channel?
No. They used to throw joints. I was protected by a certain amount of chicken wire. And if there were a certain set that I played that went over really well, all these joints would come flying over. I'll never forget, one hit the turntable one time. That messed me up big time.
And we had, obviously, a lot of the big name Jamaican artists followed suit and started playing the club. Jimmy Cliff.
Oh, yeah.
Toots a number of times. Andrew Tosh, and I do know you were fortunate enough to have interviewed his father, Peter Tosh.
Oh yeah, many times.
Yeah, did you shortly before he was shot, right?
I was in the room where he was shot a week before.
Wow.
Yeah, that could be a whole show right there.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that story at some point or read your book.
Yeah, I called the Globe right when that happened, because that happened like a Friday night, as I recall. I was doing my radio program on Saturday, and a friend of mine in Rhode Island called me, and she said, hey, did you hear about Peter Tosh? And she told me they had been shot. And so I immediately called the Boston Globe, got in touch with Steve Morris, and said, Steve, you know, I've known Peter Tosh for a long time. I've done several interviews with him here, New York, California, Jamaica. I said, could I do a story? He says, yeah, sure. So I got an assignment to go down there and cover the funeral. But, a tragedy. Yeah.
So tell about that. Tell me about that Peter Tosh story when you're playing the castle and the hotel and the limo and all that.
Yeah, the channel, and I think the hottest part of July, decided to have Peter Tosh play a castle in Boston over in the... Where is that? That's Back Bay? Yeah. Is that what it's called?
That's right in Copley,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so they did the show there, and it was a classic example of last-minute preparations, because his manager, the Irish fellow, and I can't remember his name right now, but I can see him, he got in touch with me before and said, could we do an interview on the radio now? And this was like a Saturday or a Sunday or something. I don't know. It wasn't a regular day. And I said, well, no, we can't just walk into a station and do that. And he says, well, Peter's here. And, you know, if we can do it, I said, you know, it's just too late. We just can't do it in a moment. And he said, all right. So how about, can you get me a limo? And I said, a limousine? And this is, you know, like a half an hour before the show's supposed to start. And I said, well, I wouldn't be able to take care of that. I said, that's not my area. And I said, well, where is Peter? And he says, well, he's across the street over here. And I said, you want a limo so that Peter can go from across the street?
By the castle?
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Statler.
At the Copley, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And, he said, well, Peter's not going to walk across the street to the show. You got to get him a limo. And I can just imagine Peter saying something to the effect that, don't ask him, I'm not going to work. I'm not going to work. No, man, it's not going to work. You know? So, I don't know, I think they got a cab or something. But the limo didn't work out. Great show.
I think I said to Dingy when he was telling me about this, if they put a limo in front of the Copley, he could have basically got in one door and out the other. And been at the gig.
Yeah, exactly. But, Peter had certain inclinations, shall we say. Yeah. And he could be obstreperous, I think is the word. He just could get very argumentative.
He had his own take on the English language, right? Particularly the music.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I know he called, Chris Blackwell, Chris Whitewurst.
Chris Whitewurst. How can him be a Blackwell? He must be a Whitewurst.
That's right. And lawyers and managers were liars and damagers, right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And how can we have oppressors? They're all downpressors.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah, it's fascinating to read about that, about his take on stuff, because he was, it's brilliant stuff.
Yeah. Well, I was absolutely blessed with him, because I got to see him and interview him in Providence, in Huntington Beach, in Long Island, in California, down at Central Park West in Manhattan, at his home in Jamaica, and got some great, great notes on him.
Did you ever spend time with Bunny?
I was with that tour. Yeah, the Bunny Whaler tour. Sure. Yeah. Now that's another fascinating character, but nobody could beat Peter though.
Toots had his own take on life as well, right? I always enjoyed talking to Toots Hibbert.
Oh, Toots?
Hibbert,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
He always appreciated where he came from, and he got it, you know.
Yeah. And I had several interviews with Toots, but Bunny, I went on the tour and I got a cover story in a magazine on that tour.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So some interesting things took place there too.
Yeah, but used to be with the robes and the extravagance. He was good right up to the end.
Yeah.
What about Mutabaruka?
Mutabaruka. I have a world of respect for him. When I wrote the piece for the Globe on the funeral of Peter Tosh, I was up the creek there trying to figure out how to close the piece. And I had put a call into Buddha Baruka's herbal poetry shop. And I hadn't heard from him. But literally, it was about 3:30 in the morning at this hotel where I was staying that the door opens and in walks Muda Baruka and made a special trip to give me a statement about Peter, which I could use to close the piece. So that worked out really, really well. I had seen Muda Baruka originally at the Western Front, and you know, he did well over there, of course, but he wasn't a big draw at the Channel. You know, he was, you know, a poet.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And then he had a band with him, and it was all. You know, it was really good, but, you know, he wasn't a big draw.
And that probably was the poetry aspect of it. Where did you see the world music and the reggae scene start to fragment, you know, when the dance hall and the newer artists, the Shineheads and the Pato Bantans came along? How did you see it fragment?
The fragmentation was along the lines of adding different elements into the mix. Sort of Baskin and Robbins ice cream style, you know, and more exotic mixtures, of which you see that in Alpha Blondy's work, for example, and to a certain degree with Lucky Dubé.
Uh-huh. The African guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, the African reggae.
From South Africa.
African reggae.
Mm-hmm. Where he was mixing Zulu.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And gospel and others. And other forms, even American rhythm and blues, soul music, and doing a really lovely job.
Where are you at with the reggae scene now?
Memory lane.
Yeah, you don't think there's anything really of value has come out of the new dance hall and gangster and.
No, not really. And reggaeton does nothing for me. But I did hear an artist from Thailand named Job. J-O-B,
uh-huh.
Who was mixing some Asian music in with reggae. And it sounded really, really fine.
Okay.
But I haven't gotten a copy of his work. But
we'll check that out and take a look. Job?
Job, yeah, J-O-B. But no, I've been doing curriculum work on civic learning and community engagement and climate change and all that.
How's the Garvey book?
It's in the freezer. It's resting comfortably, but no, I've been assigned about 5 different committees at school, and I haven't really been able to spend too much time on it. However, I have recently had several revelations that within the next year, I think it's going to be a good time to bow out of the academic environment and get on my Garvey book.
Oh, good.
Because I'm sort of overwhelmed with an abundance of riches in terms of how much information I've gathered on it. And I could easily write 3 books, which I don't want to do.
Yeah.
I'd like to do 2 books, one book on Garvey and another book on just the interviews.
Uh-huh.
You know, good. But I haven't had the time to do that.
Kevin, what are you teaching? What subjects?
Well, right now I teach a mixture. It's either U.S. History 1 and 2, mm-hmm. World History 1 and 2, Caribbean History, History of Roxbury.
Oh, wow.
All of those. And then I'm also teaching...
Did you make a plane?
Yeah. I made it more than plane, yeah. And also I teach a course called the College Experience, which is sort of like boot camp for the new arrivals.
Yeah.
And doing some intersectional curriculum work with students, trying to combine history and music and sociology and ecology, those sort of things, wow. And try to give some relevance to what's being taught rather than...
Yeah.
You know, the accomplishments of Zachary Taylor and
yeah, right.
Andrew Johnson, you know. Another interpretation of Abraham Lincoln, you know.
Millard Fillmore's greatest hits.
Yeah, Millard Fillmore, there's another story. The relevance of Henry David Thoreau. Yeah. I love him, though. I love him to death.
Good, Kevin. Thanks for. I know you're going to wind it up because you only had so long with us this morning. We're going to do this again, I hope.
Yeah.
And get some more out of you now. We got the vibe and we got the feel for your flow. And I'm sure Tim will have a million more
questions
next time we sit down.
Yeah, let me share one final statement
yes,
that I had been gifted.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
coming to the channel, there was also the side people that used to come in and help you and stuff. One of them was a lady who had her own facility to sell stuff, the Talking Drum, I believe it was called. That was Deb.
Oh, yeah.
Elizabeth Lotus. Yesterday was her birthday. She would have been 85, but she'd passed away a few weeks ago and stuff.
Yeah.
And she ran that little store every time there was a world music or reggae on there with all these nice instruments. Would you talk about that just for a second or two?
Sure. Yeah, her little store was the African Drum, and it was on the corner of Arrow Street and Mass Ave as you come into Harvard Square from Central Square. Uh-huh. And she had all kinds of artifacts, masks, music, clothing, all that sort of thing. And she had this idea of bringing it down to the channel and doing a little bazaar. And so she would set that up and talk with people and share books and ideas and all that. And she became a regular fixture, and of course was very, very productive in getting the word out about certain shows, spreading the word. And that was a great location as an outpost of the channel over in Harvard Square.
You were always tapped well into that guerrilla marketing aspect, for want of a better word, of getting the word on the street. You knew the pipeline for the mouth and the community that was right for those shows.
Yeah,
that you were that guy.
Well, it was a combination of personal contacts and being out there in the scene, and also sending out the press release to my own personal mailing, and that was anywhere between 50 and 110 pieces of mail that I would send out with the press release, hand-addressed, stamped, right, et cetera. So when that arrived to people's homes, they knew it wasn't a bill, and they would look at it right away.
Yeah, it was always very personal, and I always remember the Garvey headline, the head around your letterhead on there.
Yeah, very popular with the Plus One Club, you know?
Yeah, I think the fact that you're a 6'8" Rastafarian trapped in a little Irish guy is
that's right as well. So, in closing, I have a little thing I want to share. And this is from Dr. Maya Angelou, and I thought of it this morning as perhaps the epitaph for the channel. She said, "I've learned that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel."
Interesting.
I like that.
That's good.
Wow.
That's great.
That's a nice thing, Kevin.
That's great. And then hopefully there's a lot of people still feel good about the channel, the different aspects and the different flavors on all the different nights that it presented to different people in different ways. And for me personally, you know, the value of the world beat stage that the channel presented in the 80s was incredible.
Incredible to see.
Yeah.
More than anything, probably in the Northeast. I think it was an anchor for a lot of those tours coming out of Jamaica. It was always,
that's right.
It was always reliable that one gig was there that could anchor.
Yeah.
Coming from the Northeast and experimenting, and I just think that's invaluable. And I think you're part of that. Knowing the business as I do, the value to knowing your significance and being able to get the word out and make sure those shows were successful was incredible.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I still dream about it, you know.
Good for you.
No, literally, really.
You know? You have anything more, Tim? And just before we wind this one up, we're going to do this again with Kevin.
Yeah, this was great. I think I'll never forget your anecdote about Yellow Man lying down and scrawling Yellow Man was here. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different side of Winston Foster.
Yeah. It'd be great to hear more of your anecdotes like that, maybe when next time we talk to you.
We'll probably do a show we'll go through a show, and so we can relate them to the audience that's listening from the channel that would, you know, because when you told me when you went to this little thing for Deborah, everybody was wanting you to sit down and talk about that channel and about the certain shows because they were there. They're giving you the positive vibe and stuff. But it's just wonderful to hear some of the stuff that's in you right now, you know, and to share it with us and with all the audience out there that wants to listen to the Two Pints in a Corner.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll do it again. Thanks so much, Kevin.
Thank
you. Yeah, my pleasure. Yes, thank you.
And we'll chat later and stuff and what have you. And don't forget, Mystic Nights is coming.